College campuses in the Philadelphia area are under heightened security today after federal authorities warned of potential violence. I'm Shai Ben-Yaakov in for Dave Heller, and this is Newsworks Tonight. The threat appeared on the same website that hinted of an attack in the Northwest shortly before a gunman killed 10 at a college in Oregon last week. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, the hostile post has put some local students on edge.
The post on the anonymous online message board 4chan says somebody would take up arms against a university near Philadelphia. Many area universities sent a message to students saying the FBI is monitoring vague threats of violence around campuses. At Temple, federal agents in bulletproof vests accompanied campus police around the school's perimeter. Walking to class, Temple student Nicole McCollum says she read the threat and thought it was phony, but she's still a little shaken up.
It's pretty scary, but I think it's more of just like a threat and not like really that serious. The school's doing a pretty good job at warning us about it, and I've seen a lot of campus security today, so I'm really not that worried about it. I'm still going to class.
McCollum believes the threat was likely created by an internet troll, but says authorities had no choice but to amplify security measures.
They have to be there just in case something happens. It's really sad, actually. Unfortunately, we have to take it seriously because if we don't, something like last week could happen again.
Professors say some fearful students didn't show up to class. Others, like Temple student Evan Delera, say they're not going to skip class, but they will be on high alert.
So I might not go through areas where there might be a lot of populated students, and that's not me being crazy about this. I'm just trying to be a little cautious.
He says with last week's Oregon shooting so fresh in his mind, he does feel a little paranoid.
At the same time, it's still Monday. I still have classes that I have to go to. I have a big review for a test today, so it's not going to hold me back from going to classes.
A spokesman for the FBI wouldn't answer any question about the threat, except to say that the Bureau is acting out of an abundance of caution. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
Areas of the Jersey Shore are picking up the pieces after a fierce nor'easter pummeled shore towns with heavy winds and flooding just weeks ahead of the anniversary of Superstorm Sandy. 3 years after that storm hit, we're getting a clearer picture of its long-term effects, especially on seniors. Joining me now to talk about this is Dr. Rachel Pruchno. She's director of research at Rowan University's New Jersey Institute for Successful Aging. Dr. Pruchno, nice to talk with you again.
Nice to talk to you as well.
When we spoke a year ago, you were just embarking on this study. Can you quickly remind us what you were trying to determine?
So this is a study that's funded by the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response, ASPR. They're a federal agency, and they were very interested in what effects neighborhoods have on older people who are faced with a natural disaster. We have a panel of people that we've been following since 2006. And we went back to these same people that we've been studying, and we asked them a lot of questions about their neighborhood and how cohesive was their neighborhood and how much do they talk to their neighbors and how much do the neighbors help one another. So we asked a lot of questions about the neighborhood, and then we asked a lot of questions about outcomes, and the outcome that we were most focused on was PTSD. What we found in the study is that older people who live in neighborhoods where there's a lot of neighborliness going on fared much better in the face of the hurricane than did people living in neighborhoods where people really kept to themselves.
And that was the hypothesis you sort of set out with, as I recall.
It was. And, you know, the hypothesis really came from the importance of social relationships among older people in general. So we know that older people who have more social contacts do better in general.
Now, how specifically is it measured? Is it simply a survey? How do you go about that?
This was based on survey questions, yeah. So we asked questions, you know, specific questions about the neighborhood, and then we asked specific questions about PTSD. So this is all self-report data.
Now, you said this, you've been tracking these people since 2006. That's unique because that's long before Superstorm Sandy hit. How unique is it to have pre-storm data for the test subjects?
It's very, very unique. Prior to working on this study, I was not a disaster researcher, but when I started to read the disaster literature, I learned that it's very infrequently that scientists know something about people before the disaster strikes. If you don't know anything about the people before, you don't know whether the PTSD happened as a result of the stressor or whether these people had problems before. Because the sample was so big and we had the data about people before the disaster, we were able to identify a group of people who experienced home damage from the hurricane and developed PTSD. And we very carefully matched those people with people who also had home damage but did not have PTSD after the hurricane. And what's really exciting about those analyses is that there were characteristics of people way back in 2006 that predicted who would and who would not develop PTSD. So what that tells us is, you know, what we can really do when in the face of a hurricane, if we know it's coming, we know who the most vulnerable people are.
And how many people were you talking about in this study?
Has 5,688 people who were between the ages of 50 and 74 when we recruited them in 2006.
Knowing that someone is more or less at risk for developing symptoms of PTSD based on their community connections is great, but what do you do with this information? Is there a way to use it to help people who do seem to be at greater risk?
The first thing that we can do is we can identify these people. We can let people in the community, some of the religious organizations or the area agents on aging, can understand the characteristics of people that might be especially vulnerable in the face of a hurricane.
I've been speaking with Dr. Rachel Pruchno, Director of Research at Rowan University's New Jersey Institute for Successful Aging. Dr. Pruchno, always a pleasure.
Same here. Thank you so much.
During the Obama administration, few U.S. officials have had more of an impact on government intelligence policy than Leon Panetta. The director of the CIA from 2009 to 2011 oversaw a scathing review of so-called enhanced interrogation techniques under President George W. Bush. He also presided over the operation that led to Osama bin Laden's death in 2011, later serving as Secretary of Defense. Panetta will discuss his storied career at the Philadelphia Speaker Series this evening at the Kimmel Center. He spoke with Newsworks Tonight host Dave Heller.
Mr. Secretary, thanks for taking time to be on Newsworks Tonight.
Nice to be with you, Dave.
Well, with a career in public service going back to the mid-70s, what aspect of it will you focus on with your address?
I really want to kind of focus on the present and the challenges that America is facing right now. I think this country can go in one of two directions. We could be either an America in renaissance with a strong economy and strong investments and strong defense, but we could also be an America in decline if we're constantly facing crisis after crisis and politically dysfunctional, with an inability to govern.
A while back, President Obama declared something to the effect that ISIL was minor league compared to other terrorist groups. And more recently, we've learned about dismal results to date in efforts to train Syrian resistance fighters. Why are we missing the line in this regard?
I don't think we can underestimate the threat from terrorism. We learned on 9/11 what al-Qaeda could do to this country and the attacks that were made on this country. And literally, we went to war against terrorism. And we continue to be at war with terrorism. Some may not want to call it that, but it is that. It's a war against terrorism. ISIS represents the latest version of terrorism. We have a responsibility to protect our people. That's a fundamental responsibility of the president. It's the fundamental responsibility of those who are elected to office. And for that reason, it is important that we go after ISIS. The president said that the mission there is to disrupt, dismantle, and defeat ISIS. That is the mission. I think what we have to do is apply the means necessary in order to make sure that we accomplish that mission.
Are you satisfied that the Iran nuclear deal is sufficient to forestall war, at least for the tenure of that agreement?
I think, it's a gamble. That deal is a gamble. But it can also offer an opportunity. If the United States, asserts the right steps in dealing with the problems of the Middle East, I think if we use that deal as part of a larger strategy to confront terrorism and the influence of Iran, it can work in the sense that it can give us the ability to make sure they don't obtain a nuclear weapon, at least for the next 10 to 15 years. But more importantly, it can help us develop a strong defense force in the Middle East, expand our intelligence capability, restore our relationship with Israel, and try to build a strong Arab coalition force to better coordinate our efforts in that region.
Mr. Secretary, your autobiography out last year is called Worthy Fights, a memoir of leadership in war and peace. Candidates like Rand Paul say we should pretty much pull back from the Middle East and Europe and leave those areas to their own devices. How does one assess what qualifies as a worthy fight?
I think it's based on protecting the national security interests of the United States. And I don't think there's any question, but the threat from ISIS, the threat from Iran, the threat from Russia requires that the United States assert leadership on these issues. If the United States does not lead when it comes to these kinds of threats, nobody else will.
Mr. Secretary, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you, Dave.
That's former CIA Director and Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta speaking with Newsworks Tonight host Dave Heller. In today's headlines, DuPont's CEO plans to retire later this month. The chemical company says that Ellen Coleman's retirement will be effective on October 16th. Board member Edward Breen will act as an interim replacement for Coleman. The outgoing CEO said now is the right time for a new leader to continue the drive, the pace of change to capitalize fully on the opportunity ahead. Shares of DuPont jumped over 4% in after-hours trade following the announcement. A bill that would exempt stars who play at least four nights in Atlantic City from having to pay state income taxes on all shows in New Jersey that year is a step closer to becoming law. The measure is the latest of many efforts to keep the struggling seaside resort. It has become known as the Britney Bill because it encourages the sort of multi-night engagements that Britney Spears, Celine Dion, Motley Crue, and other artists have done in Las Vegas. It was approved today by a state Senate committee, but a liberal think tank has derided it as a silly waste of money. In the WHYY forecast, tonight partly cloudy, low of 49 degrees. Tomorrow mostly sunny, high up to 73. For tomorrow night, cloudy, low dropping to 58. And for Wednesday morning, clouds, afternoon sun, high all the way up to 76. And for Thursday, mostly sunny, high of 72. It's 67 right now in Center City at 619. Still ahead.
I don't think there's anyone who's run for a significant office, any office in Philadelphia, who has not at some point passed through the doors of Jerry Mondesire and sought him out.
Friends and colleagues remember former Philadelphia NAACP president Jerome Mondesire. That's coming up as Newsworks Tonight continues.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY, a season-long celebration of the Philadelphia sound. Yannick Nezet-Séguin leads the Philadelphia Orchestra in Grieg's Peer Gynt and Sibelius' Fifth Symphony. Plus, Gil Shaham performs the second violin concerto of Béla Bartók. Tickets at philorc.org or at 215-893-1999. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center. Gil Shaham, Yannick Nezet-Séguin, and the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Karen Treatment Center supports WHYY. Is someone you care about struggling, losing interest in activities they loved? Changes like these can be a sign of drug and alcohol abuse. As a behavioral health care and addiction treatment center, Karen helps families understand when professional help is warranted, offering therapies that restore wellness in body, mind, and spirit. A confidential assessment is available at 855-894-4325 or at karen.org. That's CARON.org.
Widener University supports WHYY. Widener offers over 60 undergraduate majors and concentrations, including communication studies, computer science, business administration, and more. Widener is hosting a Widener Day open house on Saturday, October 10th at 9 a.m. It's an opportunity to explore campus life with a guided tour, meet with professors, and chat with current students. That's Saturday, October 10th at 9 a.m. Registration available now at widener.edu/openhouse. Widener leadership works.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Shai Ben-Yakov, in for Dave Heller. A towering and at times controversial figure in the Philadelphia civil rights scene has died. Former Philadelphia NAACP President Jerome Mondesire died Sunday after suffering a brain aneurysm. Our senior reporter Dave Davies says Mondesire is remembered as both a civil rights leader and a force in Philadelphia politics.
Long before he headed the Philadelphia NAACP, Mondesire was a key operative in the Democratic political machine headed by then-Congressman Bill Gray. Former city councilman John White says Jerry Mondesire affected political careers in the city for decades.
I don't think there's anyone who's run for a significant office, any office in Philadelphia, who has not at some point passed through the doors of Jerry Mondesire and sought him out.
One was State Senator Vincent Hughes, who remembered seeking Mondesire support for his first campaign 30 years ago. Take a poll, Mondesire said, bring it to us, and maybe we'll help you out.
And he was putting me through my paces. He was showing me that, yes, it's about having passion for the issues, but you got to be a professional about this also and make sure all your stuff is in order.
John White says when Mondesire was working to get a slate of independent African Americans elected to city council, he could play rough.
Back in the day, Jerry played a serious hardball. He was also very hard on ward leaders who, shall I say, did not want to exercise the independence of political thought that we were advocating back then. And he could be very, very harsh.
How would he convince a ward leader to change his or her behavior?
I can't say that in public.
Mondesire remained influential as publisher of a weekly newspaper, the Sunday Sun, and as head of the NAACP. But in recent years, a fight within the Philadelphia chapter led to his removal by the national organization, and there were accusations he'd misused NAACP funds and state grants. City Councilwoman Marion Tasco, an old friend and ally, says it was hard on Mondesire.
I'm sure it had a serious impact on him. Jerry was a proud individual, and he had a good track record in dealing with issues affecting people in this city, particularly African Americans. And I think it sort of triggered the decline in his health.
Mondesire was 65. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Now that the days are shorter, you should be able to do more stargazing if you can find a spot far enough removed from man-made light. That's the topic Franklin Institute Chief Astronomer Derek Pitts takes up this week with our regular host, Dave Heller.
Derek, the Earth-Sun cycle is cooperating, as it's wont to do. It's those megawatt bulbs that get in the way.
If I did have any kind of control over lighting, those who wanted to view the night sky would not have the intrusion of all the additional city lights at night that hamper our viewing.
Approximately how compromised is night viewing in a city like Philadelphia relative to a sparse spot?
Well, let's do it like this. In the rural area where you can see plenty of stars, bright stars, dim stars, big stars, small stars, you can see the Milky Way stretched across the sky. In an urban area, you have a very different situation where you can actually see only the top two or three classes of the brightest stars. In almost any urban area, the Milky Way is not available to be seen. But that also cuts out these other objects we call deep sky objects, the galaxies, the nebulae. I was doing some work in New York City recently, and I actually was challenged to find many of the brightest stars in the sky.
So let's leave New York and Philly in the rearview mirror and head out to any of a number of national parks.
A number of national parks across the country are beginning to take on the designation of being nighttime reserve locations where the use of night lights are curtailed from car headlights and flashlights and things of that sort, so that they can preserve the beauty of the sky as much as they possibly can and then entice visitors to come to spend the night also.
Meanwhile, is there any true call to try to limit light pollution in urban areas like Philadelphia?
Of course. Sure. The International Dark Sky Association has been working very hard over the last several decades to try to get urban areas to realize the error of their ways, so to speak. And at first blush, you might think, well, it's sort of selfish. The astronomers want us to turn down the lights in an urban area so they can see the night sky. But actually, it's a little bit more to it than that. If you look at how lighting is done in urban areas across the world, you'll find that for the most part, almost 90 to 95%, the light is either architecturally decorative, meaning that you have buildings that are uplighted so that they look really grand and marvelous on the horizon, or you find that city lighting used for streets and billboards and things like that literally splash light all over. So if you can focus that light better using what are called full cutoff blinders around the lamp that direct the light downward, not only do you get more light in the places where you need it, but you're also not wasting light. So in a way, you're saving energy. So by directing light, that saves costs for an urban area. But of course, the challenge is, how do we make the changeover?
So let's come back to the Philadelphia region. What is available to be seen in our night sky this week?
All the action is happening in the pre-dawn sky. The 6 o'clock hour is just the perfect time to be out. And for this week coming up, over in the east, just before sunrise, there's a great gathering of planets. There's Jupiter, Mars, Mercury, and Venus, Venus being the brightest of them. But this grouping is now joined by the Moon. So as you go through the week, it works out like this. On Thursday this week, the Moon is going to be right above Venus. The next day, Friday morning, the Moon is to the right of Mars and Jupiter. And then on Saturday, the very next morning, the Moon is below Jupiter. But here's the real challenge and the real prize. Sunday morning, the 11th at 6 a.m., the Moon is going to be right next to the elusive planet Mercury. And I'll tell you, this really is a prize to gather. Its orbit very rarely takes it far enough away from the Sun that we can see it without much difficulty. So this is a really great time to try to do that.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Franklin Institute Chief Astronomer Derek Pitts, speaking as he always does, with Newsweek's Tonight host Dave Heller. Finally, something to get me out of bed and onto the treadmill. A student at Rowan University is close to releasing a fitness app for those who need a bit more motivation to exercise, like me. Nick Dennis noticed going to the gym is easier when you go with a partner. His app, FitDegree, is a social network in which users can scroll through potential companions and organize a pickup basketball game, find a weightlifting partner, or just find someone to swim alongside. Dennis and a business partner, Daniel Reed, hope to see the app evolve into a way to simply meet people. The two were awarded $100,000 in seed money as co-winners of the inaugural Rowan Innovation Venture Fund competition. They hope to launch FitDegree on iOS and Android in the coming weeks, so you don't have to wait until next year's New Year's resolution to start. That's it for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by myself and Kimberly Haas, with help today from Brett Rader. Check out our podcast on iTunes or listen at newsworks.org. Our regular host, Dave Heller, returns tomorrow when he speaks with Princeton professor and newly minted MacArthur Genius Grant winner, Marina Rusto. Thanks for joining us. I'm Shai Ben-Yaakov for NewsWorks Tonight.